listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past week saw the 16th summit of the Bolivarian Alliance for Peoples of Our America, or ALBA, which was held in Havana, Cuba. ALBA includes 11 full member states in Latin America and the Caribbean, including Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Dominica, Ecuador, Antigua, and Barbuda, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, St. Lucia, Grenada, and the Federation of St. Kitts and Nevis. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua in Nicaragua, one of the ALBA countries.
The ALBA summit, that's the summit of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. It was quite an important meeting for the organization as an organization. And you're talking about Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, yep. St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Dominica, Antigua and Barbuda, and a couple of other Caribbean countries that are members of ALBA. Suriname's an observer. Right. Haiti's got permanent observer status. So in terms of the region, it was quite an important meeting. And, of course, it was also a meeting of the last four governments in mainland Latin America that are governed by progressive movements, progressive political parties. Are more even revolutionary in the case of Cuba, especially, but in Venezuela and Nicaragua, and the Sandinista revolution here in Nicaragua, the Bolivarian revolution in Venezuela, and in effect, an indigenous people's revolution in Bolivia.
Yeah.
So there are four countries that have managed to resist the recent offensive over the last 2-3 years by the United States and its regional allies to overthrow governments one way or another by either locking up politicians that are likely to win elections, as in the case of Lula da Silva in Brazil, or co-opting treacherous individuals as they have done in Ecuador with Lenin Moreno, and so forth. And in Chile, of course, the big thing, that the reason people like Sebastián Piñera can win in Chile is because left and progressive forces are divided. And if you added together the progressive vote in the first round of the elections in Chile, unless I'm misremembering, they had a clear majority over the right wing vote. And the right wing win because progressive forces are divided, as they did back in 2015 in Argentina.
Right, and some people stayed home. Argentina and Brazil. I mean, look, the strategies that are conducted, it's kind of funny and almost ironic, except it's so disingenuous. They're reporting in the U.S. right now, that's been rolling through the media the last couple of days, the same thing that's been reported, quote-unquote, a number of times since 2016, that here's proof that the Russians were targeting black voters in the United States by peddling fake news that would tend to suppress the vote. In other words, negative stories about Democrats that would discourage black voters from turning out. This is the same canard that was used. As a matter of fact,
right.
Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report sent that on Facebook before, a headline from the New York Times. I'm guessing it's from like 1918 to 1922 or something, about a Communist Party Congress that was held in Riga in the dawning days of the Soviet Union, and talking about organizing Negroes around the world against imperialism, and that this was, you know, proof of the Russian meddling, you know, among the black folks in the United States and elsewhere. It's the same thing going on now, and it's the same story, only when they offer evidence, it's like, and here they spent $4,000 doing it. In fact, exactly that kind of behavior is what we've seen targeting progressive voters in Argentina, Brazil, with a full court press suppressing Lula's ability to even be on the ballot, for example, constant warfare against the state in Venezuela and other places, all intended to dampen support for progressive politics, because that's the only way they can win, these guys.
Yeah, and so in that context, the ALBA summit over the weekend in Havana was extremely important, and what they talked about was they themselves, the leaders there, Nicolas Maduro, Miguel Díaz-Canel, the Cuban president, Daniel Ortega and Evo Morales of Bolivia, Ralph Gonsalves of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. I think is it Dominic Skerrit, though? I've forgotten
the
name of the prime minister in Dominica, but all the leaders agreed that they needed to focus on unity. They needed to not reinvent, but certainly reactivate in a more dynamic way the various initiatives that have made ALBA so successful over the last 10 years, in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, President Miguel Díaz-Canel from Cuba, in advance of the summit, tweeted the words of Hugo Chavez at the founding of ALBA, you know, 2004, I think it was, or 14 years ago or whatever, that ALBA is the necessary union of the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean, a historic project, the formation of a geopolitical space that is just beginning, as the name ALBA means sunrise. And so even though they're 14 years into it, they see this as a long-term project that is just, you know, gathering together.
Yeah, and Miguel Díaz-Canel also wrote in spoke in his speech about the importance of ALBA in terms of changing the nature of international relations in Latin America, and how important that has been, because ALBA is a solidarity-based body in which everybody has the same weight. An island nation like Dominica, or an island nation like St. Vincent and the Grenadines, or St. Kitts and Nevis is another member of ALBA. And they all have the same weight as much bigger countries like Bolivia or Venezuela. It's an attempt to establish a new vision of international relations based on solidarity and genuine cooperation,
right.
Rather than the phony development cooperation that is used as a neo-colonial tool by the countries of North America and Europe in particular. And if you look at ALBA, well, what have been its headline projects over the years, and they've assisted well over 2 million people to recover their sight in different countries. They've eliminated illiteracy in Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
Amazing.
By the UNESCO's benchmarks, and so on. And the role of Cuban and Venezuelan medical schools for the ALBA countries has been tremendous in terms of training up a new generation of medical professionals who are focused on a solidarity-based approach to and a community-based approach to medicine. Now, and that's, and when people talk about revolution, the visions that people conjure up are barricades and flags waving and stuff like
right.
that. But the nitty-gritty of revolution is actually that stuff. Creating a generation of people who think completely differently about, how they do medicine or how they do teaching or, that's what's truly revolutionary. And that has been a tremendous achievement of ALBA within the ALBA framework, within the ALBA countries. So where it's tended to be weak is in stuff like they talk about achieving economic emancipation, but that's extremely difficult in a world that's dominated or has been dominated up till very recently, almost entirely, by the financial system of the United States and Western Europe. And that includes crucial things to do with trade, like insurance. So, when ALBA was set up, I remember back in 2008 doing an interview with the head of Nicaragua's central bank back then, a guy called Antonio Rosales, a very smart guy. And he was explaining to me back then that one of the weaknesses of ALBA was that, for example, that it doesn't have its own insurance mechanisms to guarantee oil tankers and the airliners and stuff like that. And Rosales pointed out these various weak points that ALBA really needed to work on. But in that context back then, it was very difficult to do because, how do you kind of suddenly set up a reinsurance company that is able to cope with large-scale disasters, for example.
Right. Where do you get a few hundred billion dollars to underwrite whole block worth of economic activity?
Yeah, right. So in all the social stuff, ALBA has been incredibly successful.
Right.
But in the kind of financial and related services area, it hasn't been so successful by any means.
Right.
And so what? But that's changing now. And that one of the reasons that it's changing is because in response to the ALBA initiative, apart from its political offensive, the United States and its European allies have also engaged in an economic offensive that has forced, paradoxically, major global players in particular in terms of trade, but that, of course, that's going to spill over into financial services and stuff. So you've got China and Russia talking about setting up their own financial arrangements, their own equivalent to the SWIFT financial transaction service, for example.
Right.
And they have the capacity to do stuff like set up massive underwriting operations for insurance purposes and so on. And we can see the way that over the years, in an incremental way, China in particular has engaged in currency swap arrangements. Argentina is a country in Latin America that has done that with China, for example, and they're engaging in trade in their own country, their country's own currencies. For example, with Iran and other countries, and so as the United States has intensified its ultimately futile attempt to impose economic sanctions on everybody in the rest of the world. And what the rest of the world has responded by setting up its own working out ways of doing things that bypass the United States. And yep. So what you've got in Venezuela, one of the suggestions that came up at the ALBA summit was that Venezuela is encouraging its ALBA partners to use the petro as a common currency for various transactions. The petro is that cryptocurrency that Venezuela has introduced as a way to try and escape, to some extent at least, the domination of international financial markets of the dollar. So, and that's, and who knows how that's going to pan out. It may work, might not work, we don't know. But I mean, the point is that you have these four Latin American countries and five or six Caribbean countries all working together to try and work out ways of doing things as a block, as a coherent block, in a way that avoids the domination and the hegemony, if you like, of the United States. And that was one of the fundamental things that came out of this ALBA summit. So, and you know, the other things that they came out with are pretty conventional. You know, they're talking about the need for multilateral trade, the need to recognize fundamental principles of international law, you know, like non-intervention and non-aggression.
Right.
All those, you know, all those absolutely fundamental things that the United States completely ignores from one moment to the next. And they express solidarity with Nicaragua. They express solidarity with Venezuela. And obviously they express solidarity with the Cuban Revolution.
Right.
And they express solidarity with Evo Morales, who is the next in line for, in Bolivia, where they're the next in line for the kind of offensive that we've seen in Nicaragua this year, in Venezuela over the last few years, and against Cuba that we've seen over the last few decades. So it was a very important summit, in fundamentally in terms of reaffirming the right to sovereign development by the peoples of the member countries of ALBA, and also looking at ways of enhancing their unity and looking at ways of escaping from the financial and economic and trade domination of the United States. And of course, there, if you look at ALBA when it was founded, look at the moment in which it was founded, 2004.
Yeah.
You know, and Venezuela was under siege from the United States.
Right.
Back then, Haiti had just had its legitimate government overthrown in a coup, and it was a very bad moment in terms of that kind of initiative.
The U.S. had just invaded Iraq. There was, you know, every kind of threat was being made against North Korea, against Cuba, you know, against all of the quote unquote outliers of the empire, basically.
Yeah. So, and ALBA was founded at a very disadvantageous and adverse moment in terms of international relations, precisely as a means to change that.
Right.
Now, here we are, what are we, 14 years later? The situation is very different in the world. The United States is in decline, very, very clearly. And Russia has military superiority over the United States now, if we can believe the claims about their new weapon systems. China is rapidly overtaking the United States, if it hasn't done already, as the leading economic power. Although the statistics might not say that in practice,
right.
In terms of dynamism and initiative, I mean, which is the country in the world that is leading the world in trade initiatives and investment initiatives? It's certainly not the United States.
I would say in terms of if tomorrow everybody decides we're no longer honoring anyone else's paper documents, where are the factories? When China says turn out 1,000 cars by 3 o'clock this afternoon, those factories will get to work. When they say it in the United States, somebody will call China and they'll get hung up on.
Right.
So, in terms of the actual economic power, there's been a real transfer that's not really part of the discussion yet.
Yeah, and so that's the new context in which this latest ALBA summit has been held, ostensibly in very adverse circumstances, again, in a Latin American context. But the election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador recently is a very clear sign that, and with other things being equal, and people at grassroots will vote for progressive leaders who offer them real policies, not just neoliberal mumbo jumbo, pie in the sky.
Right.
So, there's this kind of mismatch between the economic reality and the apparent political reality.
Yes.
That the United States has been able to manipulate for itself over the last where would you put the change? 2015 and the vote in Argentina?
I guess, maybe a little earlier, but yeah, I mean, at the coup in Honduras, I don't know where you would.
The soft coup in Paraguay.
Yeah, but anyway, right.
And 2012. But over the last few years, the United States has been able to kind of manipulate things in its favor, but it won't be able to do that forever. And that is one of the things that the ALBA countries are insisting on, that, you know, they insist that Latin America should be allowed to develop on its own terms without constant intervention from the United States. And that what the United States' response to that is to start kind of blaming China and attack China and say, well, you know, we need to stop China getting more influence or Russia getting more influence in Latin America.
Right.
But even right-wing governments like Argentina then turn around and sign a string of very important economic agreements and trade agreements with China.
Right.
So what does that tell you about the development of U.S. influence in the region?
See, because this is an entirely different element of the overall dynamic than existed, say, 30, 40 years ago during the Cold War. You know, if the U.S. and was able to marshal, you know, some measure of unanimity among itself, the Europeans and Japan at that point, say, 30, 40 years ago, facing some other countries and saying, look, we're going to cut you out of the world economy, meant you were cut out of the world economy. Now, if the U.S. says we're cutting you out of the world economy, and China says, well, except for us, there's a whole different situation there for the target country. Because, again, you know, the U.S. might take orders for sales of cars from the target country, but they can order direct from China where they're being built.
Right. Yeah, so that's this new context in which the ALBA summit took place, and among the special characteristics of the ALBA group is the special place that the Caribbean has within it. For example, in their final declaration, they reaffirmed their continued support to Caribbean countries in their claim for compensation for the genocide of the native population and the horrors of slavery and trafficking.
Right.
So you won't see that in many international declarations in which, for example, the Organization of American States. Can you imagine that?
No, there's an awful lot of very, very good work on reparations that's taking place in the Caribbean, and it is completely shut out of places like the OAS and other institutions. UN, too, by the way, in practicality.
Right, And similarly on climate change, and countries look at what happened to Dominica and Barbuda in the last very serious hurricanes.
That's right.
And their economies were completely wiped out.
Destroyed.
Now, and in terms of Nicaragua's representative in the recent the COP24, the Conference of Parties number 24 in Katowice on climate change. And Nicaragua made a point of mentioning Dominica and Barbuda at that high-level conference and as an example of countries that are being seriously affected by climate change and are getting practically zero support from international countries who are actually responsible, principally responsible for climate change. And so that's another area where the ALBA countries like Bolivia, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela are defending the members of the ALBA bloc, you know, and on at things that are absolutely fundamental for the well-being and the future of people in the Caribbean, especially smaller countries like Dominica and Antigua Barbuda and so on. So, and of course that is why the United States is mounting an increasingly aggressive assault on Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, because they are the kind of the holdout countries, the redoubts of progressive policies and revolutionary policies in the region. And they are the countries that Colombia or Argentina are not going to speak up on behalf of people in the Caribbean, right? And so if people say, well, why is the United States, or why do we accuse the United States of targeting Nicaragua and Venezuela, isn't it just their own internal failures that have led to the different kinds of crises that those countries have suffered? And you hear that argument from liberals and progressives in the West, and then when Nicaragua and Venezuela try to defend themselves against And the sanctions and the measures that the United States applies, and those same people will say, "Oh well, they shouldn't be doing that. Those are violations of civil and political rights that shouldn't happen." But it's almost impossible to explain to people that the reason the United States is behind these attacks is because Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia. Are the only countries in the region with governments that defend the basic right to development of people in Latin America and the Caribbean. That's why they're under attack, essentially. And you can say, oh, well, it's because the Cuban Revolution or because the Bolivarian Revolution or because. But the fundamental reason is that the United States does not want to see ordinary people, the impoverished majority, realize a decent life and realize their right to development. That's the fundamental reason.
Exactly right. When they talk about it's because of the Cuban Revolution or Bolivarian Revolution or whatever, that isn't because of those things. The objection to the Cuban Revolution was exactly that basically it was producing a Cuba that wanted to chart its own course. It wanted to develop itself. It wanted to uplift its people. It wanted to apply its own wealth to solving its own problems. That is what couldn't be tolerated.
Yeah, and so what you then get are these completely irrational stories about, you know, Nicaragua. Daniel Ortega and the Sandinista government took power in Nicaragua or took office in Nicaragua in 2007. And in the 11 years, it's 11 years now, almost
9
12.
Years. Sorry. 11. Yeah, you're right. Sorry, go ahead.
They've completely turned the country around economically. It's been the most economically successful country in Central America and among the most successful in the whole region ever since 2010, 2011.
And by every measure.
So then In social measures, not just in economic measures, in social measures, gender representation, all that, all those
quality,
things.
All of it, yep.
It's been the most successful country in the region. But you then get people saying, well, it's because Daniel Ortega is so repressive that there's been this crisis in the country, that we had earlier between April and July.
Right.
But that's completely irrational, because in just a month before the crisis broke in April, there was I think it was the Mitofsky or Latino Barometer, one of those regional polls, came out with a finding that Daniel Ortega was the most popular president in the region.
Right.
So you get these, why was he the most popular president in the region? Because of the tremendous social and economic advances that Nicaragua's people have experienced over the last 10, 11 years.
Right.
So then, and that is precisely why there was a crisis, because the United States and its local allies deliberately engineered an attempted coup.
Right.
Because the Sandinista government was so successful, and now they're getting to work on Bolivia, aren't they? Exactly the same mechanisms that they've used in Venezuela and in Nicaragua that are now being put into place in Bolivia, and we'll see more of that in 2019.
The interesting thing is that the long curve of events there, demonstrates that the U.S. is going to lose the attempt to own Latin America, and this development project is going to happen, and that's where the long game goes. But what it seems like they're trying to do is kneecap progress as it develops in the hope that somehow it's going to stop it eventually. But I don't think so, and we got to go because we're out of time. So
right.
We could pick it up there and kick that around next week if you like, Tony. I appreciate it.
Sweet.
You got it, bro.
Thanks a million.
Thank you, too. Take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Worlds Apart. It's been blamed on the advance of populism or the revenge of the deplorables, but the norms of public discourse have visibly shifted over the last few years. And it's not just in the United States where Donald Trump continues writing history with his misspelled tweets, but also in the UK, France, and other countries with seemingly established standards of public discourse. Is the Old West becoming wild again? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Michael Stopfer, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Communications at NATO and currently Managing Director at Oxford Analytica. Mr. Stopfer, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure to be here, Oksana. Thank you.
I know that in your current capacity, you are advising clients on the situation in the Middle East, which is usually thought of as a far riskier and more unpredictable region than the stable and civil Western world. But given the events in France, the very violent protests there, as well as less than orderly Brexit negotiations, don't you think that your clients are perhaps more perplexed figuring out what's going on in their own neck of the woods?
Well, that's an interesting question. I like the way you called it, the Old West becomes the Wild West. Well, I still wouldn't think that it's so easy to compare like that. We at Oxford Analytica, we advise clients all over the world. And it's quite difficult to compare one region with another. But I would not say that it's more unpredictable in Western Europe or the West than it is in the Middle East. The Middle East, I know we want to talk about Europe, but the Middle East is an extremely unpredictable area at the moment because, you know, everybody thought that the Gulf was such a stable area. And, you know, we have lots of very good relationships with the Gulf and Gulf governments. But what happened recently, as you know, with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and the Khashoggi killing, you know, whatever one concludes out of this means that the Gulf and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, such an important country, is somewhat unpredictable situation at the moment. So I think I think. But as far as the West goes, okay. So you want to talk about Europe? It's true that things are very unpredictable now in the West. And today we've just got all this new stuff about the Brexit vote. And as you say, it's fundamentally based on this populist wave that we're facing.
Now, in one of your interviews, you advise businesses to maintain a so-called horizon scan about trends that could potentially impact their businesses. If I'm an international investor thinking about investing in France, the UK, or the United States for that matter, how clear and long is that horizon at this point?
As we just said, I think in every region, pretty much every region at the moment, things are somewhat unpredictable based on perhaps two areas. One is this feeling of this is unpredictability because of the populist wave that has struck us all the way from, you know, the Midwest of the US through France, through England, etc. The other is the amazing speed of technological change. And as you know, whether we're talking about cybersecurity, fake news, junk news, or whatever, this has changed the structure and the framework in so many different ways. As far as Europe and the West and the US goes, though, I mean, these are obviously very important markets. And even if there are currently some, you know, difficulties, say, in France with President Macron, I would say that France as a whole is doing very well, and Germany is doing very well. So if you like, the heart of the European Union are still extremely prosperous and attractive places to invest. And frankly, the US is still this enormous and important market.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do not want to exaggerate the extent of difficulties, as you put it, that the West experiences. But I think you would also agree with me that 2-3 years ago, something that we are seeing in many of those countries would have been unthinkable. And I'm not only talking about the election of Mr. Trump and his policies vis-a-vis the World Trade Organization, tariffs, etc., but also, what we are seeing on the streets of France. Because to be honest with you, it's not much different from what I saw on the streets of Benghazi 8 years ago.
Well, I wasn't in Benghazi. I don't know. Take France. The populist wave that brought in this incredibly stupid, to my mind, Brexit vote in the UK. Or that brought in all sorts of different political movements across, as you call it, the Western world, in fact, brought in a very positive change in France, because they brought in this young, pro-reform, attractive leader, Emmanuel Macron, as president of France. And personally, I have an enormous respect for President Macron. What he's been hit with at the moment is this same backlash against the forces of globalization, the same people who've been left behind in this tremendously global wave of globalization, which has changed the structure of society in many ways. But I wouldn't say that it is that what you're saying in France is as bad as Benghazi.
Well, as of now, people are not being lynched on the streets of France, but I'm sure you know that there is a lot of looting and a lot of criminal activity in addition to the protest activity that's going on there. I cannot help but ask you, why do you think Western media are having such a different lens on the events in France compared to the events, let's say, in Libya in the beginning? Because in the very beginning, police brutality there wasn't comparable to what we are seeing in France.
Okay, Oksana, I really don't think you can compare. Let me
why
say...
Why not?
Well, I'll tell you. Because in Libya, you had an extraordinary government that had been through many different changes. You had this dictatorship of Gaddafi for decades. In France, you have a very ordered, well-ordered democracy. And I think that France is on a good trajectory. And I would say that you're completely wrong there to compare that with Libya. But I would say that we must all, in the West or throughout the industrialized world, think about how to deal with the people who've been left behind in the great progress of globalization. Because who's lost in globalization? The people who have lost are that what you call the working class, the working class in North America, in France, even in Germany, and certainly in England. And they have made these voting decisions that frankly are going to hurt them in the long run, but they've done it out of protest. So I would not compare it with Libya, but it is a serious phenomenon all the same.
Well, I just want to make clear for our viewers that when I was comparing the situation in Libya and France, I was comparing the levels of violence and the levels of criminal activities rather than political systems, which are clearly very different. Speaking of which, in one of your articles, you wrote that this expression of discontent, whether through the ballot box or on the streets, was ultimately produced by this growing divide between the so-called establishment and the people. Do you think it's more political or economic in nature? Is it ultimately a crisis of representative democracy, or is it a crisis of a misbalanced economic system?
Okay, it's not all the people. There is certainly a distrust, or if you like, a rejection of the establishment of institutions by some people, not all the people. The people who feel disenfranchised are the less economically advantaged white working class, or maybe what you want to call the middle class, in the United States. In England, it is the northeast of England and the northern parts of England who felt that industrialization that was a big driver for the prosperity in that part of the region, in part of England, 50 years ago, has now completely collapsed. They're left without jobs. The same thing in rural parts of France, I would say. So that is a feature of globalization, which has indeed increased inequality, cause problems for these people who feel left behind, and cause them to make a protest vote. They just wanted to protest. They just wanted to say, we're not doing well. But what they've done is they voted in certain cases, for instance, in the case of Brexit, directly against their own interests.
Let me ask you a question that's very dear to my heart as a Russian. In all these three countries that we mentioned, this theme of the super rich versus the common man is very prominent. And for me, as a Russian, it's a very loaded discourse because on the one hand, income inequality is a real problem. But on the other hand, in this country, the populists who exploited this narrative a century ago led the country down a very, very grim path. And at that time, a century ago, Russia was doing relatively well economically. Do you think history can repeat itself?
Well, that's an interesting question. So you're saying, will there be a Bolshevik revolution in Western Europe 100 years after the first one? Interesting. I think not. Because the countries have gone on a very different path. But it is true that there's serious discontent. And the other thing is that technology is making a difference, because technology is vastly important and useful for the people who can handle it, for the elites, if you like. Technology is another factor that is increasing the divide between the haves and the have-nots. And those who are not so familiar with technology, who are worried about the progress of modern technology, are the same people who are voting for these protest parties and feeling again left behind. So I think they are hit with, if you like, a double whammy of globalization and technology. And the only answer in these countries that we're talking about in Western Europe and, frankly, North America is education. Much more money in education, much more money in training, to give people the chance to have that equality of opportunity on which the democracies in the West are based.
But those kind of measures that you're advocating are going to take years, if not decades. I mean, all the countries are stretched in terms of their budgets. You wrote in one article that there is still a need for disruption in the West, some need for a shakeup of the ossified system. How do you make sure that it's just disruption and not a catastrophic disruption?
Well, you can't, can you? And that's what we try and, you know, when I say that, you know, at Oxford Analytica, we do horizon scans, we try our best to look across the horizons and seeing what disruptive technological or social or political forces are coming towards you. And obviously, you cannot, in a way, predict that. And to some extent, technology is socially neutral. I mean, technology and science come at us without any kind of political baggage attached. It depends how we use them. And you say it'll take a long time, but the only hope is to make sure that people are technologically competent, to make sure that people understand. And frankly, when we talk about junk news or fake news, which is such a problem in so many countries, the only chance to deal with that is to have a well-educated, aware, civically conscious citizenry.
But with all due respect, I think many of the people that take to the streets in France these days, they think of themselves as educated citizenry. They rely on technology to coalesce, but they also, at least some of them, employ very, very violent means. I know that you don't like this comparison of mine between France and Libya, but I think for many people, even in France, it's a little bit nerve-wracking to see those events unfolding in their own country. Do you think President Macron has any lessons at all to learn from the Arab leaders on how to deal with that public discontent, how to handle it?
No, I don't think you're right to make those connections. There's an enormous difference in culture, in economy, in history and society between those two parts of the world. So I do not think you can say that President Macron could learn from, say, Arab leaders in dealing with this matter, with no disrespect to the rulers in the Gulf. No, That France has its own distinctive history. And by the way, France has a tradition of social action. After all, what's the greatest revolution of modern times? Well, perhaps the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution.
Well, the French Revolution was extremely bloody. According to some estimates, about 1 million people died as a consequence of that revolution.
I haven't finished. The point is that the French have a tradition of social activism. And in 68, there was another time when people took to the streets. But the people who are upset in France are the people who come from the less well-off parts of the country, and they feel that the changes that have been happening throughout the West have left them behind without much hope and perhaps less well-off than their parents. And I'm sure that President Macron does understand that. I'm sure that President Macron does understand that and is committed to changing
Absolutely. That. Absolutely, but it's not only about what President Macron understands, but also about how a police force behaves on the streets. And I think we have seen some pictures of extremely troubling behavior on the part of police, them beating the protesters.
No, I don't agree with you. I think that inevitably, when you have protesters in the streets of Paris at the Arc de Triomphe, of course the police are going to try and stop
them.
Is that
inevitable only in France, or would that also be inevitable in Libya, Syria, and Moscow?
I'm not talking about Libya or Syria. I'm talking about industrialized countries with a long tradition of relationship with institutions. And I'm sure the same thing would happen in Moscow. The same thing would happen in England. The same thing would happen in France. And I would not get too worked up about it. And no, I do not think that the police have been particularly brutal in France. I disagree.
So you would disagree as well with the analysis of a number of French experts who say that police currently stretched to its limit and it's no longer fully capable of responding to the looting and other kinds of criminal activity perpetrated in protest areas. I guess the question I'm asking is whether you believe that France has full capacity, the skills, the ability, the technical capacity to deal with those kind of protests on its own.
Absolutely, I certainly do. And I think that France will not, I mean, I don't think in a few months that we'll see much sort of left of this particular protest movement, frankly. I think there's a protest movement that comes in the same way. Mm-hmm. It's the same people who voted against Brexit, against the European Union in the UK. It's the same people who vote for these extremist parties. It's a sense of rejection of the establishment because there's a percentage of the population, even in a country like Sweden, you know, a marvelously democratic country, who feel left behind, unable to deal with the economy, unable to get good jobs. And politicians have got to find some way of reaching these people.
Okay, well, Mr. Sopforth, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Michael Stopford, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Communications at NATO and currently Managing Director at Oxford Analytica. Mr. Stopford, your stint as a top communications guy at NATO coincided with NATO broadening its canvas from the North Atlantic region to really the entire globe. Given what we have already discussed, the instability, political instability, and sometimes security instability in some of the presumably safest countries of this planet, do you think NATO strategists may have miscalculated major security challenges?
Well, you know, when I was at NATO, there was a tremendous focus on Afghanistan, and unfortunately, that hasn't gotten a great deal better. But there was a movement to look at what we call new and emerging security challenges, and that included things like cybersecurity, some nuclear issues, and terrorism. And I have to say, Oksana, that in those days, and it's only 7 years ago, there was a very good collaboration with the Russian government in certain areas. I worked on a science program, and we had this great consortium called Standex that worked very closely with excellent Russian laboratories in St. Petersburg, etc., mm-hmm. and the French Nuclear Commission, and others. And it was a time when there was much more collaboration on things like anti-terrorism. So I regret that isn't the case today.
I wanted to press you on that same question once again. Let me reformulate that, because I think NATO for a very long time has been focusing on external threats. Do you think it may have underestimated the potential internal threats to security? As somebody who used to work for NATO, do you think you will ever see NATO forces deployed to pacify crowds within NATO countries?
No, I don't think that's even within the NATO charter. NATO is by its constitution externally facing. And, you know, there's a famous Article 5 of the NATO alliance, which says basically that it's a common defense organization. So, no, I don't think that. But I do think that it is a pity that, for instance, in certain areas, there isn't more collaboration today between NATO and countries outside, including with Russia. And I say, you had a very brilliant ambassador at the time, who is an excellent Russian ambassador, Dmitry Rogozin. There was a very good American ambassador, Kurt Volker. And I think, you know, we need more of this collaboration rather than less of it.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because both Dmitry Rogozin and Kurt Volker are still, to some extent, involved in the Russian politics, or in the case of Mr. Volker, indirectly in Ukraine. Speaking of which, there are many people in Russia who believe that at this current stage, where there is almost no relationship between Russia and NATO, very limited relationship, many Russians believe that it is the Ukrainians who are sort of holding NATO hostage and preventing it from developing better ties, or at least more productive ties with Russia. Given that your former boss at NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, now serves as a non-staff advisor to President Poroshenko, who do you think is the tail and the boss, the tail and the dog, rather, when it comes to Ukraine and NATO?
Your questions are very leading, aren't they?
Are you trying to tell me that there is no relationship between NATO and Ukraine, and they do not coordinate their policies and their politics? That's not true. They clearly do that.
Well, I mean, it is true that, you know, there was a lot of discussion, as you know, about Ukraine becoming a member of NATO, and it was decided at the highest levels of the North Atlantic Council that Ukraine would not be a member of NATO for the time being or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not totally up, because I'm not at NATO anymore, to tell you exactly what the current relationships are. That the Ukraine issue is a problem between Russia, NATO, and NATO at the moment. And I'm sure that people, for instance, like this excellent American ambassador, Kurt Volker, is doing his very best to have people talk to each other.
Now, Mr. Sopford, I asked you a couple of questions as a communications professional, but let me also ask you a question as a strategist, because this is ultimately what you do at this point of time. When you were working for NATO, were your colleagues planning, preparing in any way for the course of events that we saw developed in Ukraine? Did they foresee that as eventuality, and did they take any measures to prepare for it?
Well, there's all sorts of contingency planning and scenario planning in many different directions. And I assume that people, you know, strategists think about all sorts of eventualities. But all I can say at the moment is that I regret that in the aftermath of the Georgia situation, and the aftermath of then later on what's happened in Ukraine, that there is not more open channels of discussion. At the same time, it's fair to say that, you know, the usual diplomatic relations continue between Russia, Western capitals, the United States, as you know. So I wouldn't paint things as blackly as you're putting them right now.
Well, from what I know, there is almost no communication between Russia and the United States at this point, at least no formal communication. There's Twitter, of course, but I'm not sure that helps bilateral relations. Anyway, I want to ask you one more question on NATO. NATO's current Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, issued a statement the other day in which he dedicated 7 paragraphs to describing Russia as a major challenge, 2 paragraphs to terrorism, and another 2 paragraphs to the question of defense spending. Do you think that's reflective of how NATO sees its biggest problems, 65% on Russia and the rest split between terrorism and budgeting?
Well, as I say, I'm not at NATO any longer. The last time I was at NATO headquarters, I went to see the people on, again, the communications and public diplomacy side. And I understood that there were some internal reforms happening, and that NATO was again thinking more about the whole range of international security threats. So not focusing specifically on Russia, but on a range of emerging security threats across the board, including general functional, critical issues like cybersecurity. It's true, of course, that there's a lot of focus on the Western-Russia relationship at the moment, but I do not think that that is exclusively what NATO is thinking about. And I think there are many other areas. At the same time, you know, things go in waves. There was the end of the Cold War, which was a much more promising time between NATO and the countries of the former Soviet Union. Then there was all the focus on Afghanistan. Then things got a little bit better when I was there with this relationship working together on such things as anti-terrorism. At the moment, with developments, however you want to put it, but for instance, in Ukraine, things have now got and the issues around intermediate range missiles, etc., things are more tense again. But again, I think things go in waves and phases, and I wouldn't see this as just going in one direction.
Let me ask you one more question about defense spending, because it's been present in NATO's internal negotiations for decades, and yet the only tangible progress in the only tangible increase in non-US spending occurred only after Donald Trump deployed his very peculiar form of persuasion. Should we, as Russians, draw a conclusion from that NATO, its generals, its bureaucrats, only respond to hard bargains?
I think it's a budgetary matter. President Trump indeed has his way of communicating, but you have to hand it to him that sometimes it's better to try and shake up the established way of doing things in order to come to a different conclusion. So you might say that in some ways he's been rather successful. But the economic, it's purely economic. We talked about the economic difficulties. You said yourself that it'll take forever to train and educate people so that we can try and get away from this populist wave at the moment. Why? Because it's all about budgets. Budgets are stretched. So if you spend more on defense, that means you're going to spend relatively less on health and education, doesn't it? So no government wants to spend more on defense necessarily, because it means they'll have less money to spend on domestic social issues. Hence, there's been a big pushback against reaching this famous 2% of spending on defense matters, which being a NATO objective.
Now, speaking about President Trump, whether you love him or hate him, you will have to agree that he's redefining both political and public discourse. As a communications professional, what do you find most striking about him?
There is something to be said for the advantages of going against conventional wisdom. After all, you know, large government organizations tend to get stuck in a rut to a certain extent, and international bureaucracies as well. I was almost 20 years in the UN and the World Bank before I started working for NATO. And I know that the way these large organizations move, they tend to move in one direction. And then the same people tend to be in charge, you know, between government and international organizations and lobbying, et cetera, et cetera. So what he's done is he's shaken things up and he's brought, to some extent, a new perspective. So I would say that, you know, you can, as you say, whatever your particular views on one particular policy, he's brought some fresh air into decision making. So in that way, I would say that, you know, he's brought some positive change. But from a communication side, I think what's worrying is this focus on you know, fake news and junk news, because one of the foundations of a democracy has to be the trust in news, facts, and information. And if that trust is fundamentally shaken and the independent media are criticized, then I think that that's a problem from a communications perspective.
Well, as long as those media are indeed independent and not politically biased, you know, one of the things that has driven the Russians up the wall about the Westerners is their hypocrisy, you know, this extolling of principles in public and the betrayal of those principles in real life. And I think Trump, to a large extent, has abandoned that pretense. Is that a good or bad thing? Do you think it's better to have politicians pretend they're better than they are, or come across for what they are, even if that means ugly?
Well, you know, I mean, why do people get into politics? I think people get into politics for very good reasons and sometimes very selfish reasons. And I wouldn't throw all the politicians under the bus, as you just have. There are obviously some very responsible and principled politicians on all sides of the spectrum. I mean, in the US, if you're talking about the US, I mean, look at the Kennedy family. With all their ups and downs, they stood for values and they did some remarkable things. Or on the other side, look at somebody like McCain, who really was, you know, a man of principle.
Well, let's not start a discussion on the Senator McCain, because he was also very instrumental to funding the insurgency in Syria.
I know, but you asked about politicians. You were just trying to imply that, you know, they were all hopeless and we shouldn't have any trust in them. I think there are good and principled politicians, just as there are selfish and corrupt ones as well, in every country.
Well, this is not what I was trying to say. I was asking you a direct question of whether sometimes it's better to tell the truth, even if it's ugly, or pretend that things are better than they
are. I think it would certainly be good to tell the truth.
Okay, well, on that we will have to agree. I really appreciate your time with us today. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Oksana.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going in our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.